Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now commencing the study of the book of Nehemiah. Today we'll do chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. Our context is this. Our last book that we covered was Ezra. Ezra had returned from Babylon under a decree of the Persian king, who is now ruling Babylonia. The Persian king Artaxerxes I, who ruled from 465 to 424. Ezra had returned in 458. He had effected temple reforms, put some gold and silver in the temple, got some priests and Levites into Jerusalem to help serve the temple, reform their morals, their intermarriage with pagans, done a lot of stuff. That was about 458. That was the whole book of Ezra. Now, we are about 14 years later in roughly 445 or 444 BC, depending on whose date you use. About 14 years later, and now Nehemiah is going to begin his ministry. The scene starts in Susa, the capital of Persia. We're not in Jerusalem anymore. Before we begin the book, let me give you some introductory material. I got this from the ESV Study Bible. First of all, who's the author? Well, Nehemiah wrote part of the book, at least, because the book contains some of his own records. But now, as far as the rest of the book, who wrote it? Either could be Nehemiah himself, but most people seem to think that Ezra wrote most of the other parts of the book of Nehemiah. In favor of this idea, some scholars say that Nehemiah is written consecutively as one book with Ezra. And gotquestions.org says that both Jewish and Christian traditions recognize Ezra as the author. Adam Clark disagrees. He says the style of Ezra and Nehemiah is so very different. Well, these stylistic arguments, I'm sometimes convinced by them, but a lot of times it's just the style changes because the genre of writing changes. So I'm not going to go with the style argument there. We'll go with the Jewish and Christian traditions and say that Ezra wrote most of the book of Nehemiah. Now, Clark says, even though Nehemiah was not the compiler, but that the book was compiled out of journals or memoranda made by Nehemiah himself. So that's reasonable. We can just say speculatively that Ezra edited the book, compiled the book using Nehemiah's original source material. Now, some key dates in order to study the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah went from Persia, from Susa, to Jerusalem in 444 B.C., and that's the date I'm going to use because it's so easy to remember, but the ESV Study Bible has 445 B.C. Wikipedia has either 445 or 444. The reason is because the return of Nehemiah, the going of Nehemiah to Jerusalem happened in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, and how do you calculate that? Is that the year he exceeded, the first full year they ruled? And as always, these dates are controversial. We get within 1 year or even two. I'm fairly happy. So let me give you a summary of the four returns that the exiles made that are recorded in Scripture. The first, of course, is the return under Zerubbabel, the political governor of Jerusalem, who returned in 538 B.C. upon the decree of Cyrus. And again, sometimes you'll see 537, but I'm going to use 538. And then Zerubbabel came back under Cyrus, and then Ezra under Artaxerxes I, he came back in 458. That's a hard date. Everybody agrees with that one. And Nehemiah's first return, because there were two under Nehemiah, his first return is the third return of the exiles. That was in either 445 or 444. I'm going to use 444 because I like that number. It's easy to remember. And then Nehemiah's second return, he came back to Jerusalem about 12 years or so later, and somehow, well, actually, it's within a 10-year time period between 433 and 423, according to the ESV Study Bible. The ESV Study Bible says that the end of the book is 433 B.C., so the events in Nehemiah cover 13 years. The book itself starts about 14 years after Ezra, and then the events in the book cover about 13 years. So we're talking about a short time frame here, which is nice, easy to remember. Here's seven themes in the book of Nehemiah. Number one, the Lord's protection for his people. Number two, the need for the people's faithfulness to the Torah, to the law. Number three, the need for the people's faithfulness in worship. Number four, the Lord hears prayer. Number five, the Lord works providentially through powerful leaders. Number six, the Lord is merciful and faithful to his promises even though his people aren't faithful to him. Number seven, God's people need to avoid moral weakness. Well, that sounds like the whole Old Testament. It sounds like the New Testament. Let's look at some background in the book of Ezra. We see that the second temple had been built already. The first temple, Solomon's temple, had been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586. The second temple, the foundations had been laid right after the Israelites returned from the exile under Zerubbabel, 538 BC. By 536 BC, they had laid the foundation. They quit. They had persecution. They were building paneled houses. They quit for 16 years. They quit building. But 520, after Haggai and Zechariah had exhorted them to start building again, they started building again in 520 and finished in 516. However, the walls of Jerusalem had not been rebuilt, at least in a permanent fashion. And so the rebuilding of the walls has now become the main concern of Nehemiah in this book. So we begin now in Nehemiah chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. During the month of Kislev in the 20th year, when I was in the fortress city of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, arrived with men from Judah, and I questioned them about Jerusalem and the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile. They said to me, "The remnant in the province who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace. Jerusalem's wall has been broken down, and its gates have been burned down." Now let's talk a little bit about Nehemiah. Who is this Nehemiah? Some have thought he was a priest. Gill reports that idea, but he denies it. A lot of Jews believe that. The idea that he became a priest comes from 2 Maccabees 1:18, which I will read in Gill's version of it, ancient King James English. "Therefore, whereas we are now purposed to keep the purification of the temple upon the 25th day of the month Kislev," that's Kislev, "we thought it necessary to certify you thereof, that you also might keep it, as the feast of the tabernacles and of the fire, which was given us when Nehemiah, offered sacrifice, after that he had builded the temple and the altar." Well, it could be the priest operating under the authority of Nehemiah, so I'm not going to take that as dispositive evidence that Nehemiah was a Levite or a priest. John Gill mentions another piece of evidence that Nehemiah might have been a priest. In Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 1, we read this, "Now on the sealed document," that's the document of confession of the people for their sins, "now on the sealed document were the names of Nehemiah the governor." Well, just because the governor's name on it doesn't mean he's a priest, he's a governor. That's why you would put the governor's name on it, because he's the big shot in charge. So, no, we're going to say that Nehemiah was from the tribe of Judah. We don't know that for sure. Nehemiah is the son of Hakaliah. Who this Hakaliah is unknown, as John Gill says, but a website called pantheon.org says that it is highly probable Nehemiah was a descendant of the tribe of Judah and a member of the royal family of David. So it's speculation that Nehemiah is from Judah. Zerubbabel was. It makes sense, the leaders of Jerusalem being of the tribe of Judah, because that's where the king comes from, the Lion of Judah on the throne. The time when Nehemiah got the bad news about the exiles in Jerusalem, those are the exiles that had returned under Zerubbabel in 538 BC because of Cyrus's decree in 539 or so BC. So during Kislev, which is the ninth month, November, December, is wintertime, in the 20th year, that's the 20th year, not of Nehemiah's age, of course, but of the reign of Artaxerxes, who ruled from 465 to 424, and those are firm dates. If you take 465 and you take 20 from it, you get 445, which is close to 444, the famous date of Nehemiah's return. But now this is not Nehemiah's return yet. This is just when he got the bad news. It's going to take, we'll see, between 3 and 4 months before he gets himself back to Jerusalem. But at any rate, we are somewhere around 445 now. And we are in Susa. Nehemiah's in Susa. Where is Susa? Well, that's the famous winter capital of the Persian Empire. The summer capital, when it got hot, they would move up to Ecbatana in Media, up to the north. If you will look at a map and look at the famous Tigris and Euphrates rivers, they come together right about 50 miles from the Persian Gulf, and they run into one stream, and I used to know the name of the stream. It's Arabic, and people don't quote it very much, and I've forgotten it. But in that one stream then runs down into the Persian Gulf. Well, if you look at the head of the Persian Gulf, and if you go northwest for about 50 miles, you'll hit the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River. But if you're at the same point at the head of the Persian Gulf and go straight north about 200 miles, you hit Susa. It's to the east of the Tigris River, fairly close to the head of the Persian Gulf. It's on the Coaspes River, which runs down from the mountains down to the plain there at Susa, then eventually runs into that body of water, which is receives the flowing together of the Tigris and Euphrates River. So that's where Susa is, a very famous place. BibleAtlas.org says now it's a gloomy wilderness with lots of ruins. I think that you can go there and see ruins, if I remember correctly. There and also Persepolis, which is another Persian city. I think it was built later than where we are now. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But, of course, we can't get there now because the crazy people in Iran rule the area. And so now people like me that want to go can't go there unless I want to risk my life, which I don't. Now, the messenger from Jerusalem is named in verse 2. His name is Hanani, one of my, Nehemiah's, brothers. Well, what does brothers mean? Well, that word in Hebrew is ambiguous, just like it is somewhat in English, and in Chinese is very ambiguous. It could be a natural brother, or it could be a member of Nehemiah's family, not necessarily a sibling, like a cousin, or it could just mean a fellow Jew. So we don't know exactly who this Hanani is, but he comes to see Nehemiah. Nehemiah questions Hanani as well as the men who came with Hanani from Judah. He asked them about Jerusalem. John Gill says he asked them, has Jerusalem been rebuilt or not? Because that's, of course, what the exiles were supposed to be doing. Could have been he was just asking for the general condition. The response was not pleasant. Hanani and friends tell Nehemiah that the exiles are in great trouble and disgrace, and that would be because of their enemies, the exiles' enemies, the Samaritans, the rump population which had been imported into northern Israel after the destruction of northern Israel by Assyria in 722 by Sargon II. Now, more particularly, the messengers, Hanani and his friends, tell Nehemiah that Jerusalem's wall has been broken down. Now, as Kyle and Delitzsch say, that doesn't necessarily mean the whole wall had been destroyed. Perhaps only portions of the wall had been broken down. When we get to Nehemiah 3, we will see that it's probably only pieces of the wall that are broken down. Of course, a wall that's not complete is no good. All an invading army has to do is go right through the cracks. Now, Hanani and friends tell Nehemiah that the wall has been broken down and its gates have been burned down. Now, there is a big disagreement over when Hanani and friends are referring to. When was the wall broken down and when were its gates burned down? Well, I'm going to give you four options. The first option is that Hanani and friends were referring to the condition the Babylonians left the city in 586 when they came in and burnt the city down. John Gill says it's unlikely that the walls were rebuilt after 538 when the exiles had come back and then torn down again. Ellicott agrees and says, quote, there's no valid reason for supposing that the walls of the city had been in part restored and again demolished. In other words, the Babylonians knocked them down and not a thing's been done to rebuild them. The pulpit commentator says this, quote, there is really no reason to believe that the demolition effected under the orders of Nebuchadnezzar in 586 BC, no reason to believe that the demolition done by Nebuchadnezzar had ever hitherto been repaired or the restoration of the wall even attempted. Okay, well, that's simple enough, but let's look at option number two. The exiles had come back in 538. They rebuild the temple foundation in 536, and they rebuild the wall at the same time, and since then, somebody had knocked it over. Or, in the alternative, they started to rebuild the wall in 536 when the foundation had been laid, and the Samaritans, their enemies, had stopped them from rebuilding the wall, and it therefore remained in ruins. Now, to back this option up, we can read verses in Ezra 4, namely verses 12 and 13. These verses were written right after the foundation of the temple was laid in 536. We read this, Ezra 4, 12 and 13. And these are Samaritan officials speaking to Artaxerxes. Let it be known to the king that the Jews who came from you have returned to us at Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that rebellious and evil city, talking about Jerusalem, finishing its walls, and repairing its foundations. Let it be known to the king that if that city is rebuilt and its walls are finished, They will not pay tribute, duty, or land tax, and the royal revenue will suffer. So there's a reference that the Samaritans had given to Artaxerxes that the Israelites were finishing the walls. And if those walls are finished, so they're in the process of being rebuilt, but they haven't been rebuilt yet. And the Samaritans stopped them. Well, that sounds like a pretty good argument to me. But the pulpit commentary vehemently disagrees, saying this, quote, "The Samaritan accusation in Ezra 4:12, the one I just read, that accusation falls short of a statement that the wall was restored, and, if it asserted the fact, would be insufficient authority for it." In other words, the pulpit commentary is saying the Samaritans were lying to Artaxerxes. The Jews weren't really finishing its walls. They were just worried that they were going to finish the walls. So they kind of embellished the situation. Yeah, they were rebuilding the city and the private homes and the temple, but they weren't building the walls. That's according to the pulpit commentary. Pulpit commentary also says this, quote, "The supposition of Ewald," another commentator, that, quote, "As soon as the city was rebuilt, the attempt would be made to fortify it." Well, that makes sense. Why wouldn't the Israelites try to rebuild the walls as soon as they got there? Well, the pulpit commentator says, here's why, because that proposition ignores the jealousy of the Persians and their power to step in and prevent a subject town from fortifying itself. Okay, well, here's option number three. The Israelites rebuilt the walls after the completion of the temple in 516, and the wall was broken down by the Samaritans after that. The ancient commentator Ewald, quoted by the pulpit commentary, affirms that as an alternative. And also, option number four, Ewald quotes this as another option. The wall was broken after it had been built somewhere between Ezra's return in 458 and Nehemiah's return in 444. Well, you can see there's a great deal of disagreement as to when the city walls were torn down. Were they torn down by the Babylonians, or did the Israelites get them back up and then have them torn down again at some time, either the building of the temple foundation or the finishing of the temple, building of the foundation in 536, or the building of the temple in 516, or even sometime after that? Who knows? Doesn't really matter. We go now to Nehemiah 1, verses 4 through 6. "When I, Nehemiah speaking, heard these words, I sat down and wept. I mourned for a number of days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I said, Yahweh, the God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God who keeps his gracious covenant with those who love him and keep his commands, let your eyes be open and your ears be attentive to hear your servant's prayer that I now pray to you day and night for your servants, the Israelites. I confess the sins we have committed against you. Both I and my father's house have sinned." Now, how many days did he fast and pray? It says a number of days. Clark says it's about 4 months by looking at the dates that are offered in the book of Nehemiah. From Kislev, which is the ninth month of the sacred calendar, not the civil calendar, but the ninth month of the religious calendar, that's November and December, to Nisan, which is the first month of the sacred calendar, which is March or April. So there's about 4 months. So Nehemiah received the bad news from Hanani and friends in Kislev, November, December, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign, which is about 445, 444. And then he goes and tells Artaxerxes about 4 months later in the first month of Nisan. We read that in Nehemiah 2:1, during the month of Nisan in the 20th year, I went to the king, and so forth. So why the almost four-month delay? Well, one of my commentators said, nobody knows, but the pulpit commentator came up with four interesting speculations as to why Nehemiah waited almost 4 months to talk to King Artaxerxes I. Here's the first possible reason. Perhaps the king, Artaxerxes, and his court were staying the winter at Babylon instead of Susa, as they sometimes did in the winter. And Nehemiah is in Susa, not in Babylon, so he didn't have a chance to see Artaxerxes. Option number two, perhaps Nehemiah was at court at the same time Artaxerxes was there in Susa, but he, Nehemiah, had not been called on to perform his cupbearer duties for 3 or 4 plus months. They might have had other cupbearers doing the job. Option number three, Artaxerxes I may have not noticed Nehemiah's grief. And of course, Nehemiah is not going to speak to the great king first. The king would have to address him first. Option number four, Nehemiah may have actually tried to conceal his grief. Persian subjects were expected to be perfectly happy in the presence of their king. So those are four good reasons, or four possible good reasons why it took so long for Nehemiah to go talk to Artaxerxes about the problems in Jerusalem. So going back to Nehemiah 1 verse 4, where we were, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept, heard the words of Hanani and his friends about how screwed up Jerusalem was. Nehemiah sat down and weeps, he cries. Now, Nehemiah may have been quite shocked about Jerusalem's condition, as the pulpit commentator says. Nehemiah had no means of exact information. He perhaps hadn't known about the problem too much before, and perhaps he even thought that the city was flourishing under Ezra. He knew that Ezra was there, and all of a sudden he gets this great shock that the city is in bad, bad shape. So he starts crying and starts fasting. Fasting, of course, is not only done to get God to answer a prayer, it's also done for mourning purposes, and Nehemiah is truly mourning here. So in verse 5, Nehemiah prays. I said, again, he's relating the prayer. I, Nehemiah, said, as he prayed to Yahweh, this is what he said. Yahweh, the God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God who keeps his gracious covenant with those who love him and keep his commands. Now, those words are so similar to Daniel 9:4 that the pulpit commentator says that Nehemiah must have had Daniel in front of him, or either Daniel had Nehemiah in front of him, the books, not the persons, the people, but the books. We read Daniel 9:4, I prayed to the Lord my God and confessed, Ah, Lord, the great and awe-inspiring God who keeps his gracious covenant with those who love him and keep his commands. Well, that sounds exactly like verse 5 in Nehemiah. Ah, Yahweh, the God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God, great and awe-inspiring God, same phrase, who keeps his gracious covenant with those who love him and keep his commands. It's kind of interesting. These two exilic characters are apparently aware of each other, or at least of each other's writings. Now in verse 6, Nehemiah starts out with his prayer by saying this, I confess the sins we have committed against you. Now you notice that Nehemiah did not blame the sad state of affairs on bad luck, or that's just the way life is, bad things happen. No, he blamed it on sin. Now the interesting thing is he blamed it on our sins. We have sinned, he says in verse 6. Now, I have a question. How can an individual confess the sins of other people? This reminds me of the Christian fad several years ago. Christians would go around confessing the sins of the church, and they'd say, oh, we're so sorry, Muslims, we're so sorry for the Crusades. And I thought, oh, yeah, here you are, a Protestant Christian, confessing the sins of something that happened, what, 500 years ago? Actually, longer than that. Over half a millennium ago, that you had nothing to do with, you're not even a Catholic. No, you can't confess the sins of other people. I remember I was reviewing a book for a man who was writing a book. He's gone on to be with the Lord now, but he was a marketing expert at the time and was a pretty good writer. He'd been on TV. And he sent the book to me for my review. And I reviewed it and I said, look, you can't confess the sins of other people. You confess your own sins. Well, he wrote back and said, well, I'm going to put it in there anyway, because we got to be relevant. We have to be woke, as we say it now. Well, but can't you say that Nehemiah confessing the sins of other people backs up this man who was trying to confess for the Crusades? Well, the difference is that Nehemiah was a leader of the people. That's how he has the right to confess sins of the people. My friend who was writing the book was not a leader of the Crusades. We go down to Nehemiah 1, verses 7 through 8. Nehemiah continues his prayer. We have acted corruptly towards you God, towards you Yahweh. We have not kept the commands, statutes, and ordinances you gave your servant Moses. Please remember what you commanded your servant Moses. And now he quotes Moses. If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. Well, we're going to look into a lot of what Moses said. First of all, we'll notice the condition. If you are unfaithful, well, that condition that Moses had given, that Nehemiah is quoting Moses as saying, we can read the condition. Deuteronomy 28:58. This is Moses, of course, writing the law. This is the famous cursings chapter. If you are not careful to obey all the words of this law, there's the condition. If you are not careful to obey all the words of this law, which are written in the scroll, by fearing this glorious and awesome name, Yahweh your God. So the condition is, you got to obey. And if you don't obey, you're going to get scattered among the peoples. Leviticus 26:23. If, there's the condition, In spite of these things, you do not accept my discipline, but act with hostility towards me. In other words, if you don't obey me, you're going to get scattered. Deuteronomy 4:23. Be careful not to forget the covenant of the Lord your God that he made with you, and make an idol for yourselves in the shape of anything he has forbidden you. In other words, keep the covenant. Keep the words of the Lord. Obey him. If you don't, bad things will happen. Now, Nehemiah just mentions one of those bad things, which is getting scattered, because that's what happened to the exiles. They had gotten scattered from Jerusalem in 586 B.C. by the Babylonians. Well, let's look at Moses' promises, his curses if the law was not obeyed. Deuteronomy 28:64. Then the Lord will scatter you from all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you will worship other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. Leviticus 26:33. But I, Yahweh, will scatter you among the nations, and I will draw a sword to chase after you, so your land will become desolate, and your cities will become ruins. Deuteronomy 4:27. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be reduced to a few survivors among the nations where the Lord your God will drive you. And of course that happened, well, first of all, it happened to the northern Israelites, later known as the Samaritans, in 422 B.C. They were scattered by the Assyrian king Sargon II, but also the southern kingdom, Judah, by the Babylonians in 486 B.C. They perfectly fulfilled the curses in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. They were scattered. And of course, Nehemiah is perfectly aware of this. He's aware of why the exile occurred. He's aware of the Mosaic Law. We go down to Nehemiah 1, verse 9. Nehemiah is still praying. He's still quoting Moses. He's quoting the curses from the book of Deuteronomy. But if you return to me, Yahweh says to Moses, if you return to me and carefully observe my commands, even though your exiles were banished to the ends of the earth, quite relevant for the Babylonian exiles in the time of Nehemiah, even though your exiles were banished to the ends of the earth, God continues speaking to Moses, I will gather them, I will gather these exiles from there, from the ends of the earth, and bring them to the place where I chose to have my name dwell. And of course, that's Jerusalem. So there's your promise, not only of scattering, but of gathering. The return, of course, that's a major theme of the Bible. The return back to Zion, which of course is the theme of the New Testament, as all the nations return back to the new Zion, which is the Church of Jesus Christ, which is fulfilled ultimately in the New Jerusalem. Let's see where Moses promised a gathering of the people. Where is Nehemiah quoting from? Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 5. When all these things happen to you, the blessings and curses I have set before you, and you come to your senses while you are in all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, i.e. Babylonia, now run by Persia, and you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and all your soul by doing everything I am giving you today, by keeping the law, then Yahweh will restore your fortunes, have compassion on you, and gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. Even if your exiles are at the ends of the earth, he will gather you and bring you back from there. The Lord your God will bring you into the land your fathers possessed, and you will take possession of it. He will cause you to prosper and multiply you more than he did your fathers. So there you have the return promised in Moses. And of course, Nehemiah he knows that the return from Babylon to Jerusalem is a fulfillment of Moses' prophecy there. Nehemiah keeps praying. He's still quoting Deuteronomy. He's still quoting Moses. He says this in verse 10, chapter 1, they are your servants and your people, the Israelites. You redeemed them by your great power and great hand and strong hand. He's quoting from Deuteronomy 9:29. Moses says to God, but they are your people, your inheritance, whom you brought out by your great power and outstretched arm. So you see, that's a pretty direct quote. The difference is only probably because of translation differences. So the Israelites are your people, the chosen people. You redeemed them. In other words, he's referring to the remnant that's in Jerusalem now, having been redeemed, bought out of slavery to the Babylonians. God bought them out of slavery by getting Cyrus to issue that decree in 539 to let them return in 538 B.C. with great power and a strong hand, because that was a big deal, a quite remarkable circumstance. We go now to Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 11, and we will finish this audio. Nehemiah continues to pray to Yahweh, "Please, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to that of your servants who delight to revere your name. Give your servant success today and have compassion on him," compassion on me, Nehemiah, "compassion on your servant, compassion on him in the presence of this man," referring to Artaxerxes, of course. At the time, I was the king's cupbearer, so after the 3+ months, Nehemiah finally decides to break the news to Artaxerxes. He needs some help. And of course, this is a big deal, and that's why he prays about it, and fasts about it for that matter, before he goes to Artaxerxes, because Artaxerxes very well could have said, "I don't care about what's happening in Jerusalem. Who cares? You're nothing but a cupbearer. Why are you coming to me with this ridiculous request or this superfluous request?" Now, this prayer was probably made at the very same day that he was going to Artaxerxes, because Nehemiah says in verse 11, "Give your servant success today." Now, that probably doesn't just mean a general time that is now, like today is a time of great tribulation. No, it means today, the 24-hour day. "Give your servant success today in the presence of this man." He doesn't say the king, but the Holman Christian Study Bible note, the margin has "the king," "in the presence of the king." And then an explanatory note is given in verse 11 at the end, "At the time I was the king's cupbearer." In other words, that's going to explain how Nehemiah had access to Artaxerxes. A cupbearer, as Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, a cupbearer in ancient Oriental courts was always a person of rank, importance, and influence. He had confidential duties, and he had frequent access to the king's presence. He had to be reliable, after all. People are always wanting to poison the king. He had to eat the food or drink the wine before the king drank it to make sure that nobody was poisoning the king. If somebody had put poison in that wine, the cupbearer would croak from the poison. So a cupbearer was a big deal. Cupbearer, you know, could be bribed to not drink the wine and then put poison in it to kill the king. So he had to be very well trusted by the king. So we'll leave it there at the end of Nehemiah 1, and we will find ourselves prepared to go to Nehemiah 2, verses 1 through 20, our next audio, and we will see Nehemiah returning to Jerusalem to inspect the walls of Jerusalem. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.